This episode contains spoilers for this installment's featured puzzle and parts of the hunt that this puzzle was a part of. If you'd like to attempt to solve the puzzle or try finishing its hunt before listening to the entirety of this episode, you can find and follow the link to the puzzle page found in the show notes. One of the things that I enjoy the most about hunt puzzles is the fact that you'll often find yourself learning about things that you didn't really think you needed to learn. I personally consider myself to be, by many definitions, a curious person, but I don't necessarily go out of my way to learn about things like
graph theory, My Little Pony, the programming language Pete, the Westminster Kennel Club dog show, Markov models, Beanie Babies, men's gymnastics, quantum superposition, the history of Czechoslovakia, UNESCO World Heritage Sites, Scorigami, Origami, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, bridge engineering.
It is no surprise that, as a whole, hunt puzzles have touched on many different topics from culture, geography, mathematics, science, art, sports, and whatnot, and on many occasions the subject matter of individual puzzles can skew a little more obscure or niche depending on an author's taste, background, or interests. I think there's something really beautiful and poetic about how puzzles can be used as a way to actively engage with the many parts of this complex, weird, and wonderful world that we live in. Solving puzzles, therefore, can be a way to motivate us to become more curious about the world, even the parts of it that may seem entirely foreign to us. And for most of you listening to this episode, I meant that quite literally. This is The Extraction, a podcast about puzzles and the people who make them. In each episode, we'll walk with authors through the solve path of one of their puzzles to talk about its inner workings and how it was made. Along the way, we'll get into why we write puzzles, learn what it takes to make them, and explore the many facets of the fascinating craft of puzzle writing and the culture that surrounds it. I'm your host, Justin Laudia. So if you've done puzzle hunts for a while, I think you might agree with me when I say that most well-known puzzle hunts have a fairly North American context. I don't believe that's entirely too surprising, considering we have some of the more established puzzle hunt traditions in the United States, including The Game, which we talked about in the last episode, and the MIT Mystery Hunt, which we'll touch on in a later episode. And I think it makes sense that because of how localized these experiences used to be, a lot of the writers of these hunts are American and construct puzzles that may, more often than not, use American knowledge as the foundation of a puzzle, like states or football teams or whatever. Of course, now, because of the internet and other advancements in communication and technology, the experience of solving a puzzle hunt has become more accessible, and the culture of puzzle hunts has become more widespread across the globe. Because of that, the general population of puzzle hunt writers and the information and data sets used as bases to construct solving experiences have also become more global and diverse. These puzzles have unique mechanics and methods of extraction, and we're really only able to enjoy them because we have authors from different backgrounds, contexts, and interests contributing to the craft of puzzle writing. In this episode of The Extraction, we're talking about one of those puzzles, The Scholar, which was written by Janice Heng for the 2020 Red Dot Hunt.
I'm Janice Heng from Singapore, and I'm a member of this really tiny puzzle hunt group called Flower Power. So I don't actually know the origins of it because I only joined it a bit after it was formed. But to the best of my understanding, it was formed by a bunch of Singaporeans who were studying mathematics or some sort of science at Cambridge. And I don't know why they chose such a 1960s sort of name, but they did. I was friends with a couple of them, and then only after I left university did they actually invite me to start hunting with them. So that was in 2013. And we always focused on Australian puzzle hunts, which are pretty different in pace from, you know, MIT, to say the least. So basically about 4-6 puzzles a day, each day for 5 days, and then, you know, solving goes on for a few days after that. So much more sedate pace.
And that's compared to the more well-known format of puzzle hunts today, which typically allows you to continuously unlock one or more puzzles as you progress without the restriction of a daily rate. Three of the most well-known Australian-style hunts include Metzakata, the Sydney University Maths Society or SUMS Hunt, and the Melbourne University Mathematics and Statistics Society or MUMS Hunt. One interesting tidbit here is that one of the writers of the very first MUMS Hunt in 2004 was the infamous and embattled founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. In any case, that factoid isn't particularly important here, but Janice and the rest of Flower Power did get their puzzle hunt origins from solving MUMS.
So, I mean, I've always been vaguely interested in puzzle-related things, but for the actual puzzle hunt, you know, genre, as it were, it was when I was just invited to join Flower Power in 2013. So my very first hunt was the Melbourne University Mathematics Society hunt that year. We just basically kept solving for a couple of years, only restricting ourselves to these very small Australian hunts. But roughly around the same time, I started playing escape rooms, and I set up an anonymous blog. So there I am in 2014 setting up my escape room blog. And then in early 2015, this guy called Karkian contacted me via this escape room blog, basically being like, oh, you know, I enjoy puzzle hunts as well, since I've written about them vaguely in the escape room blog. It's a sort of a thing which you might find fun if you like escape rooms. So Karkian was like, oh, you know, I haven't actually found many Singaporeans who enjoy puzzle hunts themselves, and I would like to set up a puzzle hunt in Singapore, but I don't know anyone. Would you happen to have any friends who are interested? So I brought in two people from Flower Power, Chok Young and Jack, as well as a friend I met through escape rooms, Alex. And then the five of us actually organized the first Singapore puzzle hunt in 2015, which was the first time I'd actually written a puzzle.
From what I can tell from my research, the Singapore puzzle hunt was the first widely known puzzle hunt based out of Singapore. Devised to be an in-person event, the Singapore Puzzle Hunt would eventually lead some of its members to create the Red Dot Hunt, but it was also influential in bringing the culture of puzzle hunts to the Singaporean population.
My general impression is that before the Singapore Puzzle Hunt, there were various Singaporeans who had had some experience with puzzle hunts, probably because they studied abroad in the US. So you do get, you know, stray Singaporeans in various MIT groups. So you've got all these disparate solvers experiencing the puzzle hunt in that US context, but there's no sort of central Singaporean hunt around which they might organize, or any way for them to meet other Singaporeans. Because it's not as though, you know, you list your nationality in your MIT puzzle hunt groups or anything like that. So I think the Singapore puzzle hunt was useful as a way for people to realize that there were other people out there interested in this. Although I think a much larger role was actually just introducing puzzle hunts to Singaporeans, who were much more used to just playing escape rooms like I was. The sort of learning curve from escape room puzzles to puzzle hunt puzzles is pretty steep, obviously. So the very first, the 2015 hunt, was meant to be a really simple introduction for the first few puzzles, and then perhaps scaling up a tiny bit to the sort of tougher puzzles you might see in a regular puzzle hunt by the end of the hunt. So it was a physical event, which doesn't really help either, because the time limitation you're working with is much stricter. I think for a lot of teams, they found it really tough, but it was a decent introduction to this new genre of puzzles for them. And then the next year, I think performance and sort of familiarity with the genre was much better. But since then, there's been a lot more awareness, and it's been a growing community focusing on puzzle hunts, and not just, you know, people who were curious and checked in for 1 year and then left again or anything like that.
When it comes to writing puzzles, Janice endeavors to, first and foremost, make sure that the puzzles she writes are enjoyable for the solver to experience, and she tries to avoid incorporating mechanics that require a significant amount of research to solve.
I think one motivation I have, which doesn't necessarily show up a lot, but is just making it fun in a very simple way, sort of independent of the ahas you get from solving puzzles. Just having moments of levity or, you know, just whimsy in the process of solving. I just don't like any puzzle which has a lot of uninteresting busy work, which is usually the form of Googling or, say, you know, reverse image search. So actually one of my pet peeves, as it were, is image-based puzzles where all you're doing is sort of right-clicking and reverse image searching instead of actually trying to interpret an image. Or, you know, very fact or trivia-based puzzles, which luckily don't exist so much anymore. So I prefer things where once you actually figure out, I mean, the first surface level aha, there isn't a lot of busy work involved, and it's more about seeing how things unfold from there. So I think modified cryptics are always fun, because you've got the sort of pure cryptic solving, and then figuring out, you know, what sort of devious twist Setter has managed to work in. So I guess puzzles which aren't so much based on this foundation of info that you just have to troll through a wiki to solve. I think besides just being, say, you know, a technically well-constructed puzzle, I think each puzzle should somehow either be interesting, amusing, or simply just fun. Like, even though it's really exciting and satisfying to solve a technical puzzle on its own terms, I think that element of play has to come in there somehow.
Janice brought with her this personal philosophy and approached puzzle writing to the Red Dot Hunt. The Red Dot Hunt was formed in 2015 with a couple of her fellow Singaporeans, but unlike the Singapore Puzzle Hunt, it was meant to be an online experience that was also accessible to people who live outside of Singapore.
Basically, Chokyang, Alex and I, we decided to set up the Red Dot Hunt, which would be purely online, so not therefore, you know, in competition with the Singapore Puzzle Hunt or anything like that. And the benefit of going online was also that it wouldn't have to be just for the Singapore puzzling community, so it'll be set up, you know, by Singaporean puzzlers, if you were, but for the international puzzle hunt community. And therefore also, in a small way, kind of put Singapore on that puzzle hunt map, if you will.
During writing the Red Dot Hunt, Janice's approach in selecting what kind of puzzles to write was strongly influenced by what puzzles have already been written for the event and what niches or mechanics need to still be represented.
In terms of why I actually enjoy the setting a puzzle, I've never had to think about it because I've actually only ever set puzzles in the context of a larger hunt. So I've always had to think just about how you know, balance the puzzle mix, or, oh, we are missing an image puzzle, I guess I have to come up with an image puzzle here then. So I guess I've never actually had to think about it independent of this larger context. In the Red Dot Hunt, even though we are deliberately non-hierarchical and there isn't an overall hunt editor, I've basically been the one who had to oversee the overall puzzle composition of the hunt, and therefore the cleanup crew, if you will. So I scoop up all the answers which aren't claimed, and I have to find or sort of plug the gaps in terms of puzzle types. So my starting point is always, you know, I've got this answer, and I've got certain parameters I need to meet. And then in the background, I've got this stock of like things I want to eventually someday put in a puzzle, and it's a matter of sort of, you know, matching them up, as it were. And I guess along the way, because I'm within this greater context, I don't have to worry too much about setting, say, the sort of puzzle that you enjoy because it's just so technically clever. You know, you get to a certain point and you're like, wow, how did anyone even set this? And now I've got to solve it. This is actually, you know, mind-blowing. So I don't have to worry about that sort of puzzle because I've got teammates who can cover that area, as it were. And I don't have to worry about, you know, puzzles that, say, require programming abilities or play out more like games than puzzles. And that gives me the space to just do puzzles, which I find, I mean, they could be sort of fun, say, almost filler-esque puzzles, like you get to the second round and it's been really tough, but here's a nice, quick, easy, fun thing that you can do. Or, you know, here's a puzzle which has a really niche audience, not mainstream audience niche, which is actually pretty common in puzzle hunts, like, you know, VTubers or something. But puzzle hunt niche, so like, economics, which no one actually cares about, but I'm going to put it in a puzzle because I can.
Now, the puzzle we're talking about today, The Scholar, was written for the 2020 Red Dot Hunt. And while Janice may not prioritize writing puzzles that may have an immensely mind-blowing aha, I'm of the opinion that this particular puzzle was clever in its use of specific mechanics that aren't immediately familiar to a large number of the international puzzle hunt community. In any case, we'll get to that later during the solve path. As with any puzzle hunt, the 2020 Red Dot Hunt was written with a specific theme. The Red Dot Hunt up to that point typically followed a two-round structure. The first round of the 2020 hunt was set in a fairly mundane office setting, but after finishing that round, it's revealed that the office was actually a front for the Men in Black, and that you're trying to extract information from alien allies, the Scholar being one of them, to protect the Earth from a looming threat. This theme was selected thanks to one of the members of the writing team being a fan of the Men in Black series.
There's generally a sort of brainstorming session, kind of just after the previous hunt ends and we're thinking about the next hunt, in a very loose way, in like a WhatsApp group, so not like a sit-down meeting or anything like that. And our tradition for the hunt is to always have a sort of nondescript, kind of boring first round, which then leads into the like actively themed second round. And I believe it was Chokyang, who for some reason is a Man in Black fan, and realized that in 2019, you know, this new movie was going to come out. So originally this was meant to be a 2019 hunt, but life happened, which is why it ended up being 2020. And I'm pretty sure the boring office start would have been my idea, just because of having to live the boring office life.
As Janice described earlier, she tends to write puzzles that help round out and balance the rest of the hunt. Because of that cleanup crew type approach, The Scholar was one of those puzzles that was mainly written to fulfill a need. However, this puzzle also happened to be an opportunity for Janice to present ideas that she felt strongly about.
So to be very boringly pragmatic about it, I needed a puzzle which had image elements, and I also realized that this was a perfect example to sort of bring in my pet themes and or agendas.
With all that being said, it's now time to walk through the solve path of The Scholar. If you're new to the podcast, here's how it works. In each episode of The Extraction, we talk about one specific puzzle by going through its solve path. Every now and then, we'll pause to talk with the author to explain some of the design decisions that they made. I'll ask some questions and generally try to give you a behind-the-scenes look into how a puzzle was written. If you're new to puzzling, don't worry. I try my best to explain or describe some of the more standard puzzle hunt terms that you'll likely come across later. Okay? Let's start. Upon opening the puzzle, solvers were immediately greeted with the following line of flavor text.
The scholar speaks perennial words of wisdom, if you can understand them.
The puzzle first presents solvers with 12 lines of text.
Body, to bow without bow, wine without water. Caddy, axe without father, child without son. Corpse, tail without hair, dawn without sun. Cover, military without car, contort without arm. Dagger, spoon without yes.
Each of these lines contained two sentences. The first sentence started with a single word. Then, after a semicolon, was a phrase that had two words or phrases separated by the word without. The second sentence in each line similarly followed the same X without Y structure from the second part of the first sentence. The 12 lines were ordered alphabetically by their first words. Below the 12 statements were line drawings of 12 specific animals. The animals, which solvers may immediately note as being the representative members of the Chinese zodiac, were divided into 5 groups and were arranged in different ways. The first part of solving the puzzle was clued by the flavor text and the zodiac animals. The flavor text implied language was involved, and the zodiac animals clue solvers into using Chinese. To begin, solvers needed to translate the different words of each statement into its simplified Chinese character or radical. For those unfamiliar, Chinese characters will contain one or more different graphic glyphs, and radicals are specific parts of a Chinese character that helps categorize or alphabetize it. The radicals themselves have their own semantic meaning, and some of those meanings just so happen to be indicated in the first words of each of the 12 statements. After translating all of the words from the statements into their respective simplified Chinese character, solvers may notice that the character or radical for the first English word in each sentence graphically appears as part of each of the Chinese characters translated from the second English word of the respective line. Solvers may also see that the third Chinese character translated from the English word that follows without is also visually present in the second Chinese character. This structure is consistent throughout each of the first sentences of each line, and this pattern clues solvers into what they need to do next. If that seems a little unclear, let's walk through one of those 12 statements as an example. In the statement,
cover, military without car, contort without arm.
Solvers might notice that in the first sentence, the simplified Chinese character for car is visually present in the simplified Chinese character for military. The without suggests subtraction. And it turns out that if you take the character for car and remove it from the character for military, you get the character for the word cover. Let's try another one. The first sentence of the line,
10, graduate without comparison, good without woman.
You can get the character for 10 by subtracting all the parts of the character for comparison from the character for graduate. Basically, you can think of each sentence as being in the formula A equals X minus Y, where A is the first word, X is the word or phrase in the following part before without, and Y is the word that follows after the word without. So first of all, I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to write a puzzle using the Chinese writing system as the base for it?
So I suppose there are kind of three motivations, we can say. Two of them very strictly puzzle-related goals, and one of them maybe a bit more so-called political. The first one is very straightforward. I just wanted to avoid having to do letter-by-letter extraction, because that tends to be overused, and we already had several puzzles in the mix which were using that. So I just wanted to find a way where you could extract the answer without the usual, you know, index into whatever, get a single letter for each line. The second one was just that I think the Chinese writing system has been a very rich data set. And I mean, this isn't the first puzzle by far to have used it. I recall one implementation from the Cambridge Puzzle Hunt a couple of years back, where I believe you obtained individual strokes in a certain order and you had to somehow assemble a character from that, but with no indication of the spatial relationship of each stroke. So that was very frustrating, even for us. And we were like a team of, you know, nominally Chinese speakers. Mm-hmm. And we found that really difficult. So I kind of wanted to avoid getting into just an unfun way of using this really huge data set. Mm-hmm. And I think actually the Red Dot Hunt has made an effort to use the data set of, say, you know, Hanzi or kanji or whatever, just the Chinese characters in different languages. So in the very first Red Dot Hunt, there was one puzzle set by Carissa, who isn't part of the group anymore. But it basically looked at how the same characters were used in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. So again, it's a data set which I think Puzzle Hunts could afford to mine a bit more, as long as they keep in mind accessibility concerns for people who aren't familiar with this. And then the third, I guess, kind of vaguely political motivation, if you will, is that I think being in the Puzzle Hunt community for so long and participating in so many Puzzle Hunts, one kind of gets used to seeing US-related knowledge bases as completely fine and unproblematic. But then for the rest of the world, it means that we are constantly having to look up, like, you don't even play football. You know, American football leagues or like baseball.
Yes, yes.
And oh, let me pull up my 50 states again, and the state flowers and the state flags, and like, oh, you know, I should recognize this outline of the state, which is all fine and understandable, but it's just nice to, I think, put stuff from different contexts into that mix. And kind of, I guess, force Americans, or most Americans who may not be familiar with Chinese, to have to get into this, you know, different mindset, basically. Even extends to stuff like, you know, Hollywood movies or like TV shows. I don't know all your American comedy skits or whatever. It's easier now with Netflix, but there's a lot of, you know, 90s nostalgia in there. And yeah.
So you mentioned that Red Dot was partly made or partly devised in order to include the international sort of audience. And so even though this puzzle hunt and your group is based in Singapore, how much of the sort of divide, I guess, for lack of a better word, between the Singaporean context and the international context, how much did that influence your decision in using the Chinese writing system as a base for the puzzle?
So I think our overall philosophy of the Red Dot Hunt is to make sure that the puzzles are all written with an international audience in mind. And you shouldn't necessarily get an unfair advantage if you're specifically Singaporean. So we wouldn't build an entire puzzle around the Singapore Metro map, but we might include the Singapore Metro map alongside metro maps of other cities in a puzzle, for example, just as a sort of Easter egg, I suppose. So with this puzzle, it was always set with the intention of it being completely solvable if you didn't know any Chinese at all. But if you did know Chinese, then you might get a little bit of a home ground advantage, so to speak. So we never actually write specifically for a Singaporean audience, because we do want to make this an international hunt. But I suppose we don't shy away from having aspects which might be more familiar to Singaporeans, or basically just, you know, not having to go along with the touchstones of popular culture or everyday culture, which are more familiar to international audiences.
Mm-hmm, that's fair. And now, there must be some sort of balancing act you have to have when you're writing a puzzle that sort of fits both contexts. Now, did you find it difficult to make that balance happen?
I mean, personally, I'm always terrified of setting a puzzle that becomes unfun because it's inaccessible. Or that, you know, setting a puzzle which people are just like, why did you even choose this database? So it's always a bit of a gamble, I suppose, each time one decides to set a puzzle, knowing that it could put off certain solvers. For this specific one, I guess I just spent a lot of time in Google Translate, kind of forward and backwards translating to make sure people would get the right words and so on.
Yes.
And one of our test solvers, Adit, who is very well known in his own right, obviously, from the Australian scene, and also he was in Team Luck, might still be in Team Luck. Mm-hmm. So he is slightly familiar with Chinese, but not, you know, completely fluent in it. So he was a key test solver in kind of testing how that held up.
I actually do now want to ask you about a specific thing that you wrote in the author's notes at the end of the solution page. Now, you mentioned that initially you wanted the answer to be constructed entirely from Cauchy radicals, because it uses numbers as part of, I guess it there are numbers associated to each of the radicals, and I think there's 218,
So I had to look it up on Wikipedia as well. 214, apparently.
14. Oh, okay. Okay, yep. Good to know. I'm curious as to, first of all, just for our audience that may not know what that is, what are those radicals and how would the puzzle have differed in terms of its look and its structure?
Okay, so just to clarify, Cauchy radicals aren't a different type of radical. They're just a subset of all the hundreds of radicals that are out there. So for some reason, at some point, the Cauchy emperor commissioned a dictionary or a lexicon, as it were. And I assume his dictionary compilers decided to find some way of, I guess, ordering this dictionary, because you didn't actually have the alphabetical pinyin system, which was much later. So you have to arrange all these, you know, graphical units. What are you going to do with that? You're going to look at radicals, but you can't possibly arrange it by the hundreds of radicals, because you're not really simplifying things that way. So from this huge universe of radicals, they just chose 214, gave each one a number. I'm not actually sure whether they did that, or that's just how we understood it further on, but basically grouped all the characters in this dictionary by radical. So it's not a different kind of radical, it's just a small subset of the universe.
Okay, good to know, yeah. So, okay, with that in mind then, how would the numbers have worked as a confirmation mechanism, as you had hoped initially?
Well, it would just have been something very simple, like instead of arranging the original lines by alphabetical order as they were, it would be arranged by, say, radical number, just to confirm that you had found the right radical. I think it would have been nice to have that confirmation, especially if you weren't exactly sure if you were doing the right thing. And I think just having Wikipedia always helps, right? You look at the data set, you're like, ah, I see where they got this from. I must be on the right page. Yeah.
Let's talk about the other thing in the author's notes that you had mentioned, and you mentioned that, and we talked about this earlier somewhat, but you said that having the advantage of knowing Chinese might actually be an obstacle. Could you elaborate on that and what you mean by this?
Okay, so first I should put a disclaimer, being that this could just say more about the Singaporean education system or my particular education than anything else. Like, so with that disclaimer there, so there were two radicals in particular where the sort of common term for it is completely unrelated to its meaning, which I only realized in setting this puzzle. So the first one is the radical which is named as walk in the puzzle, which is 162 if anyone's on the Cauchy page. It's pronounced chuo. And it's got a little vertical component and then a horizontal line, so like a very fancy capital letter L, if you will. And in my kind of primary school education, we referred to it as basically the boat radical, because it looks a little bit like a boat, I suppose. And then you put the character on it, right? But it actually means walk, apparently. So that was something to learn.
So you learned something while studying this puzzle. Yeah.
And it happened with another radical as well, which is the radical used for mound in this one, which is County Radical 170 Fu. And it's the one which looks like the Greek beta or the German double S. And so we refer to it colloquially as the year radical, because it looks like a year. But no, it's a mound, apparently. Yeah.
That's amazing. I quite enjoy that story. Okay, more on the statements. Now, of course, during the process of writing a puzzle, some things have to go, some things have to be edited. Did you come into a situation where you had to change any of the statements? And if so, what were the changes and what were the original statements?
So I had to go back to look at my puzzle planning document, and I didn't seem to find anything except two items. One was that I really wanted to have the line be spoon without being, because it sounds ridiculously philosophical. But sadly, Google Translate didn't agree, so it had to become the very strange, not very grammatical spoon without yes instead, which I think was a loss. And then the other one is a lot more prosaic. It was originally we had distant without dollar, but for the overall meta reason at the end, where you need certain words to appear in puzzles, it became here without essay, because we needed both the here and the essay components. So that sort of worked out well.
Now, before we move on to the second part of the solve path, I do want to ask you, was there any sort of challenges or stories from writing this part of the puzzle that we wouldn't have seen that we haven't touched on yet in this part?
So having to come up with the x minus y equation, as you were, was actually really difficult because it's extremely unconstrained compared to the other half. So I tried to keep it to kind of everyday words as far as possible. And some came more naturally, like things like tail without hair. Both words are very common, and they're also related semantically, so that is useful. But at a certain stage, I had to end up looking at just lists of characters that use each radical, which is how you end up with bizarre things like europium without gold, basically.
I really wish that this sort of mechanic sort of shows up in other puzzles now, because it is a really fascinating thing to me, at least. And so I'm glad that this puzzle sort of touched on that and was able to, it was seen by a number of people. So that's great.
So actually, if you don't mind, there is actually a cultural point that just came to mind. So there's a tradition in Chinese to have, they're called lantern riddles, dengmi, and they basically function like cryptic crossword clues, but in Chinese. So I never actually thought about it until now, but it might actually have been the inspiration for this idea of just taking apart parts of puzzles and so on. Because this would actually be how you phrase some Chinese lantern riddles. You know, it'd be like X without Y, and then you have to guess a word. And that is literally what you do. You just take out the components and stuff like that.
Are you telling me, and this is blowing my mind, that the Chinese writing system also has a cryptic crossword type thing?
It does.
Amazing.
It's actually a really old tradition. And it was recently an English subtitled, I think, YouTube video, which I will try to dig up and send to you about it.
Oh, fascinating.
But, yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, so like graphic cryptics, basically.
That's incredible. I'm sure that I'm not, like, I might be behind on that. I'm sure people in, like, some of the Discords who are into puzzles already know about this and are just like, Justin, you're so behind. But, like, that that is amazing. I'm glad that to hear that there's some sort of cryptic-ish thing that isn't necessarily Western in origin. Yep. So amazing.
After the break, we'll continue on to the second part of the solve path of the scholar. See you there. Hey folks, Justin here. I wanted to take this opportunity to let you know that The Extraction is on Patreon. There you'll get things like behind the scenes updates, bonus content, and early access to episodes. Patrons who continuously support The Extraction at the highest tier will also receive a nifty mug after 3 months. If you want to support this podcast and help it grow, please consider joining at patreon.com/theextraction. That's patreon.com/theextraction. Welcome back. We are talking to Janice Heng, and we are just about to continue with the second part of the solve path for the scholar. Let's go. Let's return to the 12 statements and focus on the second sentences of each line. These sentences were structured like the first sentences, but this time, the resulting radical or character that followed the subtraction was not given. That implied that the solver was to figure that out on their own. By applying the same A equals X minus Y approach that was used to get the resulting characters from the first sentence in each line, solvers will get a set of 12 different characters from the second sentences.
有, 害, 陈, 丑, 四, 身, 五, 虚, 冒, 子, 淫, 味.
These 12 characters all happen to be the names of the 12 earthly branches, which is an ancient Chinese ordering system that organizes a number of different things like time, dates, and years. Canonically, each of these 12 earthly branches is also represented by one of the 12 Chinese zodiac animals as seen in the line drawings in the second part of the puzzle. A bit of a side note here for those less familiar with the system, the names of the 12 earthly branches do not directly translate to the names of each animal. In fact, the characters representing each of the earthly branches have their own semantic meaning. Solvers who are not familiar with the 12 earthly branches and its connection to the 12 animals of the Chinese zodiac can easily discover this association with a little bit of research online. So at this point, solvers would now have two pieces of extracted information per statement, a radical from the first sentence and an earthly branch associated with a specific Chinese zodiac animal. After finding all of that information, solvers would need to switch their focus to the second part of the puzzle, the line art below the statements. As mentioned earlier, the 12 characters were divided into 5 groups and arranged in specific ways. The rat, ox, tiger, and rabbit were in one group, and they were all stacked on top of each other in that order, with the rat at the top and the rabbit at the bottom. The second group had the dragon and the snake, with the dragon bent and standing over the snake. The horse, which was standing on its hind legs, was followed by the monkey riding on the goat's back. The rooster stood on its own, and lastly, the dog and the pig sat side by side. What solvers needed to do here was take each radical from the first sentence of each line, assign it to the animal associated with the earthly branch that was identified in the second sentence of the respective lines, and arrange it in the same way that the animal appears in each group. Take the first group, for example, where the rat, ox, tiger, and rabbit were stacked together. The statement in the first part associated with the rat was
10. Graduate without comparison. Good without woman.
Good, minus the character for the word woman, gives you the Chinese character
子,
the earthy branch represented by the rat. Solvers then had to take the character for the word 10,
十,
which was the first word of that statement, and put it on top of the stack of characters from the statements associated with the ox, tiger, and rabbit, respectively. The statement associated with the earthy branch represented by the ox was
cover, military without car, contort without arm.
After discovering that the character for contort minus the character for arm equals the earthy branch represented by the ox, solvers would place the character for cover below the character for 10, as the ox appears below the rat in the line drawing. The tiger statement had the first word of tiny, and the rabbit's was small, which, yes, were two different characters. Stacking the characters for 10, cover, tiny, and small from top to bottom in that order gave you one new complete Chinese character. The dragon, whose statement began with corpse, was drawn hunched over the snake, which was associated with the character for dagger. Putting the character for dagger in the crook of the character for corpse gave you the second new character. The horse standing on two legs with the monkey riding the goat were associated with mount, have, and walk. By putting have on walk and placing that to the right of mound, you get the third character,
Sui,
which incidentally means follow. The rooster, who stood on its own, implied that body was the fourth character. Lastly, the characters in the statement associated with the dog and the pig were mouth and caddy, which could be put side by side to make the last character, which incidentally means hear. By reading all five of these new characters in order, you actually get the Chinese name of a brand, which in English translated to the final answer of the puzzle.
Sony Walkman.
Let's talk about the answer itself first. So how did you pick the answer for this puzzle?
So again, I have to go back to my sad role as cleanup crew. Yeah. And the fact that now I'm looking at the round two meta, which has various pairs of starting and ending fragments, if you will. And we need an answer that starts with sun and ends in man, and hopefully isn't too like blindingly obvious from a theme of a puzzle. And I wanted, as earlier mentioned, to find a way to have an answer that you could extract that isn't letter by letter, but is still unambiguous. So, okay, let's go with, you know, Sony Walkman, as opposed to something like Son of Man. And I was also very amused by the idea of using a fairly archaic data set to get to a relatively modern answer. Although maybe the Sony Walkman isn't modern anymore, but, you know, there's still that gap there, which I thought was quite funny.
Amazing. Now, so the answer itself, because of the way the puzzle worked, you needed to find an answer that in Chinese had to have 12 separate parts. I wanted to ask you actually which came first. Did you sort of come up with the mechanic for the puzzle first to the when you sort of were assigned the answer? Or was the answer sort of the inspiration from turning it into this sort of puzzle?
Yeah, so that's a very good catch. So basically, I had the answer first, Sony Walkman. I was like, what can I do with this answer? And in the back of my mind, I knew I wanted to set a Chinese-based puzzle if I could in this hunt. So I just plugged Sony Walkman into Google Translate, as one does, and realized that it had, as you say, 12 components. And somewhat earlier, a couple of years ago, I had just learned about the earthly branches, which is a bit late, maybe. But, you know, sets of 12 are always nice anyway. And if you've got a set of 12 in a puzzle that can be about Chinese characters and you know about the earthly branches and so on, you know, it's a happy coincidence, a confluence of many things.
Now, I do want to ask, because I am in the art sort of industry, who drew the animals? I'm quite interested to hear.
Yeah, it was me. You're very kind.
Oh, they were so good, Janice. Oh, you're they very amazing. Kind. Amazing.
No, but
I quite enjoyed them.
So I have to mouse draw everything because I don't own a tablet. So I just mouse drew them. Yeah.
I mean, that's how I started out. I drew out with a mouse also, and now I'm a graphic designer. So I mean, there is absolute validity in drawing with a mouse. And it doesn't look like you drew with a mouse at all. Right. So I liked speaking of the animals, I liked how the arrangement sort of clued into how you would use the radicals or the characters that you extracted from the statements. Now, how did you sort of come up with the idea of arranging the animals?
I mean, I think from the start, firstly, I wanted an image component. And secondly, I mean, the graphic nature of Chinese characters really lends itself to a very visual mapping and construction of the final answer. And also, I think when it comes to arranging animals, so I think one of the images which really stuck for me was the animals of Bremen. You know, that German fairy tale where you've got a bunch of farm animals kind of standing on each other's shoulders outside the window or something like that. So that kind of echoed for me in the very first one where you're just stacking four radicals on top of each other.
This kind of plays into this next question. One of the things that strikes me about that specific mechanic is that it seems at first glance fairly innocent in its arrangement. Like it doesn't seem like something that had like the specific arrangement, like with the I'm talking specifically about the monkey on the goat's back. And so that to me just seemed like a natural sort of illustration type thing. And it's like, okay, the monkey's on the goat's back, but you didn't realize when you were solving it, especially if you're not a sort of you're not familiar with Chinese characters, that is really clueful. And so I think for me in particular, I found it really clever that it seemed sort of innocent at first, but it turned out into being something really the informational at the end. And so for me, that's, I mean, as a graphic designer, and once again, I should say that making something that seemed invisible and sort of unknown into something that's actually really useful. The question I wanted to ask is that how often do you sort of put in these things where it seems innocuous at first, but actually is something that is useful for solving the puzzle? Is that something that you sort of do often in your puzzles?
Firstly, I can't claim credit for this particular instance, because again, it was just pure luck that things shook out so well, because the animals are actually just arranged in zodiac order. So we could have ended up with some sort of monstrosity instead, like a horse or a snake or something like that. But this was just pure dumb luck, and so I'm really glad it worked out.
Yeah, no, I'm glad too.
To respond to the broader question, I think that's actually something I enjoy a lot in escape rooms, mm-hmm. where you think something's just part of the decoration, or you know, just a normal part of the room. And then you realize sometimes halfway through that actually it's a key part to solving a puzzle. So that's one of my favorite aha moments of escape rooms, actually, just noticing when ordinary things aren't that ordinary. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad if that manages to happen in Puzzle Hunts as well, which is a bit harder because usually you are always looking at how to use every single part of a puzzle.
Yes, incredible. Okay, everything seems to come back to escape rooms, right?
It does. I mean, I have to admit, I'm actually an escape room enthusiast first, and then the puzzle hunting is still a sideline for me.
Yeah.
Which is actually something you don't usually say in polite puzzle hunts. But it's the truth. I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize for something that is really important to your origin story in puzzling. So that is absolutely, I think, why this puzzle worked out in the way it is, because you are an escape room fanatic first before you are puzzle hunt sort of enthusiast, I guess. And so the fact that the sort of ordinary turned out to be important was, I think, influential because of the escape room influence. So that's great. Amazing. This puzzle ended up educating a lot of people, including myself, on the ways that not only how you could play with the data set of Chinese characters and the radicals and stuff like that, but the language itself. Now, was education in any way part of the intent of this puzzle, or was this one of those things that just kind of happened to be part of it and people just kind of learned from it because of the way the puzzle was written?
I guess I wouldn't elevate it to the level of education, but I think awareness is something I've been trying to do, as mentioned before, for the sort of like semi-quasi-political aspect. And just making people aware that there is this whole dimension to Chinese, and it's very interesting in its own right, but also a great database for setting puzzles. I mean, I'd also recently been studying Chinese calligraphy, which made me a lot more aware of how words should be fitting together. So that played into it as well, I think.
How do you feel about the puzzle today? Like, what, are you satisfied with it? Was there anything about it that you would change if we were to remake it again 2 years later?
Yep. So, I mean, as mentioned before, I'm always a bit worried about how these sorts of puzzles might come across. So I was actually very pleased when we have a survey that we do at the end of every hunt. And this was actually a puzzle which quite a lot of solvers enjoyed, even if, like, whether or not they knew Chinese. So I'm glad that it worked for both sets of audience, as it were. Like those for whom this was a completely new area, and they were discovering something new, as well as those who actually felt that the familiarity was nice and almost representation of a sort. So there were some comments that we got in the survey which I was personally quite touched by. There was one Chinese speaker who specifically said that they were very glad to see a Chinese puzzle because they don't usually show up in hunts, and especially not US hunts. And there was another personal story, which was someone who had learned Chinese for a few years in high school and kind of liked this, you know, being able to use that again so much later. So I really enjoyed the fact that it worked for both groups.
Now, when it came to writing the puzzle itself, was there anything that kind of surprised you? Actually, I should also ask that about the reactions you got. Was there anything about the reactions as well that was surprising to you?
I was actually prepared for a lot of people basically complaining about having to spend a lot of time in Google Translate. And I don't know whether, I mean, we always have a question about the three least favorite puzzles. And I was pleasantly surprised that the scholar did not pop up very much in that front. In terms of writing, obviously, finding out that I had been getting it wrong all my life about those two particular radicals, that was pretty fun.
And so were there any other reactions that sort of stood out to you besides the one that talked about their using Chinese from having learned it in school and everything?
Well, I always like it when there's a touch of, say, you know, whimsy or lightheartedness to the puzzles. And I was quite pleased that multiple people actually thought the drawings were cute. a bit unexpected, but it was nice to have.
Yeah. Well, I think that was successful, as you already know. So now I should ask you, like, how this affected the way you kind of see writing or solving puzzles now. Did this sort of change the way you approach writing, or how did it change your, or strengthen even, your puzzle writing philosophy?
So I think you're precisely right. It has emboldened me a bit, I think, and strengthened this belief in challenging the US hegemony in puzzle hunts. Or just bringing in new and interesting aspects and not being too afraid about whether it's too unfamiliar for the audience.
Is there anything that we should be looking out for from you in the future?
Well, the next Red Dot Hunt is technically in the works, but you shouldn't look out too sharply because it's been in the works for a long time and everyone's very busy with life, so it should come out at some point. Just, you know, so we haven't completely disappeared, but we are not going to put a date to it yet.
See, okay, well, we are going to be anticipating that, not in the near future, but hopefully in some part of the near future. Now, with that particular hunt, and you don't have to sort of answer this in the context of that hunt, but is there anything that in the future that you want to explore that you might not have had the chance to yet?
So I'm going to disclaimer first that these are not spoilers at all for the next Red Dot Hunt, so don't even bother trying. But do think I want to do more with, I guess, non-European languages, but in a way that is accessible, and that's always been the problem, I think. So for instance, the Korean modern writing language, Hangul, is extremely modular and extremely logical because it was a deliberately constructed language, or rather writing system. And I think a lot more could be done with it that hasn't been done with it yet. And actually, Google handwriting is a great asset here because it opens up the solve path for people who aren't familiar in the language, including myself. I don't actually know Korean. So yeah, I think something should be done in that area if possible. And I think Japanese itself, because it's got different writing systems, and hiragana and katakana in particular, as kana systems, they're just so rich in terms of the possibilities. I've actually played several sort of escape room adjacent puzzle things in Japanese, because I do speak that language, and what they do with the characters is just really fun and inspiring, and I wish there was some way to make that kind of puzzling accessible to English speakers as well.
So you are quite passionate about languages then. That seems to be the running theme from the beginning of our discussions, that language to you is particularly important. Now, first of all, I should ask you what languages you speak. You said you speak Japanese, you speak English, and do you speak Chinese, right? So are there any other languages that you speak? Because three languages to me is really impressive.
Well, I should first credit the Singapore education system. Yeah. It forces everyone to learn two languages. And then I had the chance to learn a third also within the regular school system. So that's where the English, Chinese, and Japanese come from.
Mm.
I speak extremely limited fangled Swedish because of this one band that I was a huge fan of as a teenager.
Wait, which one, sorry?
I don't even speak it. This band called Kent.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So there was a Swedish puzzle in one of the recent puzzle hunts, I remember, that used ABBA songs. I could just translate everything visually. So that was actually really fun. I was like, oh, finally, Swedish actually has a use. And would have guessed.
Janice, you are... So you know a little bit of Swedish. Okay, well, we'll add that to the list of languages that you have some knowledge on at the very least. Now, okay.
Very normal.
Yeah. So why languages? What interests you about language in particular?
I hesitate to say that I'm actually really into languages because if you look at a lot of, say, you know, continental Europeans, they know like tons of languages, like four or five. But I think for me, in this context, I really enjoy the difference in the writing systems. I think just learning new systems in that sense is very interesting to me. And as I mentioned earlier, I have been taking calligraphy classes, Chinese calligraphy classes, in the last couple of years. So I think exploring the language as an art form has been interesting.
Excellent. That's a great answer.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call myself a linguist by any means. I am not. Just putting it out there.
It's a writing system, not necessarily the language that you're interested in. Okay, good to know. What other puzzles should we check out of yours if people want to sort of look at some other puzzles that you've written for other hunts?
I think one puzzle which I'm still fairly proud of is Jigsaw Carton from the 2018 Red Dot Hunt, which is, I suppose, my tribute to Cryptic Crosswords. And then a completely different puzzle, which I think is very representative of how I often have to create smaller, fun filler puzzles that aren't necessarily challenging, but hopefully are amusing. And that's The Socialite from the 2020 Red Dot Hunt.
Now, lastly, is there anywhere where people can find you online if they're interested in knowing more about the stuff that you do?
There's nowhere that they can find me online under my actual name, but they can always go to my escape room blog if they actually wanted to. It's escapingsg at WordPress. So just a very straightforward WordPress blog, completely anonymous, but now it's not, I suppose. From this direction, it won't be anonymous anymore.
Yes, please do go check out Janice at their escape room blog. But Janice, this has been lovely. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me here. And I hope to see more from you, especially at the next Red Dot Hunt, whenever that may be.
Thanks very much. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to Janice Heng for joining me to talk about her puzzle, The Scholar. If you want to see the puzzle itself or check out the rest of the puzzles from the 2020 Red Dot Hunt, you can find a link to the website in the show notes. This week's episode of The Extraction was made possible in part to this podcast Patreon supporters. I'd like to thank all of our new patrons who have joined us since after the first episode of The Extraction aired, but I'd also like to give special thanks to Renee Ngan, who's supporting us at the Indexers tier, and to James Sagrano, who's supporting us at the Solvers tier. If you want to also get a shout out at the end of each episode, become an indexer or solver supporter of the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/theextraction. That's patreon.com/theextraction. You can also find some of the content that I wasn't able to put in this episode, so do consider checking it out. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at ExtractionPod. The Extraction was written, hosted, and produced by me, Justin Ladia. We'll see you in the next episode, where we'll talk to another puzzle writer and travel down its solve path. Bye!